From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Can black people be unabashedly proud to be American? Some people point to slavery, racism, and ongoing discrimination and say they would never claim this nation as their own. But other folks will point to moments in black history that show patriotic zeal under the most difficult of circumstances. There's Crispus Attucks, the first man to die in the American Revolution back in 1770, and of course the many men and women who have served in wars over the years. Today, the question of black patriotism has come front and center in national politics, especially for Barack Obama. His former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, got heat for his stinging critique of America.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people.
It has made some people question Obama's allegiance to the nation. So how do black Americans reconcile experiences with racism on the one hand and pride in our national identity on the other hand? Joining me now is Roger Wilkins. He's the author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He's also the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History and American Culture at George Mason University. We've also got Farrah Jasmine Griffin. She's a professor of English and African American Studies at Columbia University. Farrah and Roger, welcome.
Thank you.
So in my introduction, I set up this dichotomy between the people who feel patriotism doesn't take into account America's failings and other folks who say that you have got to claim your place on this soil as your birthright. So, Professor Wilkins, you've said you consider yourself to be a patriotic American. You've also written extensively about some of this nation's worst moments when it came to the treatment of black people. So how do you and other black Americans who consider yourselves patriots explain your pride in this nation, even though you believe this nation has sometimes put black folks through hell?
I can't speak for other Americans. I can only speak for myself. Two things quickly. First of all, I was a kid during World War II, 9 years old when Pearl Harbor occurred, 13 years old when we bombed, atom bombed Japan. War propaganda is at about the level of a 12-year-old. And so the war propaganda got me. That was one part of it. But the much more complex part is this. My ancestors helped build this country and helped build the wealth of this country. They may have been enslaved workers, but their backs and their blood went into this country. My great-grandparents were Mississippi field slaves, and they were tenant farmers until they died in the 1910s. I can't. This was their country. They believed that someday their grandchildren and great-grandchildren would enjoy freedom. I wouldn't be here without the strength and determination of those people. And they were Americans with an American promise in their heads, and I think it's my obligation to help deliver that promise.
Professor Griffin, now you have described black patriotism as complicated but not naive. Can you explain what you mean?
Certainly. I think that the majority of African Americans have expressed pride in their nation and a form of patriotism, but it's not a blind patriotism. For instance, they haven't been blind to our nation's support at times of something like apartheid in South Africa, and they certainly haven't been naive about the ways that the government itself has not always acted in their best interests. It's acted despicably towards them at times, but I think that there's always been this belief in a hope for the possibilities of our nation and a belief that the nation could change, that the very Constitution itself is elastic enough to make it change. And so that's the kind of patriotism I'm talking about when I say complex but not naive.
In February, Michelle Obama was stumping for Barack in Wisconsin when she made this statement about her own patriotism.
Let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country. And not just because Barack has done well, but because I think people are hungry for change.
You know, Dr. Griffin, why did that statement of national pride draw so many critics for Michelle and for the entire Obama campaign?
Well, I think it's for this very sort of naive sense of what patriotism constitutes, that statements like that are automatically seen as un-American or unpatriotic. And I think that for many people, not just many African-American people, but for many people, there have been moments in our nation's history that we are not proud of. We cannot be proud of the genocide of Native Americans, for instance, that there are moments when we aren't proud, but that we nonetheless stake a claim in the nation and believe in it. To believe in it and be pro-American doesn't mean that we're proud of any and everything that we've done, but I think that that's why people misread Michelle Obama's comments.
Well, let's talk about the other side of the dichotomy in black opinion. More than a century and a half ago, Frederick Douglass delivered a stunning 4th of July speech. We have a snippet of NPR's Tony Cox reading from that speech.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your prayers and hymns, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages.
Now, on the surface, this could be read as anti-American. Roger, in your book, Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism, you write at the end that Douglass was, quote, a giant in the great American tradition, flipping the idealism of the Founding Fathers and using it to help strengthen democracy. So why have African Americans, in critique, sometimes held on to the idea that America can change and also that we have to be the agents of that change?
Well, you know, it's only the yahoos who believe that in order to be patriotic, you have to jump up and down, wave the flag, and agree with everything the government has ever done in the history of the world. That's really stupid. I think Frederick Douglass was one of the greatest Americans because he used democratic practice and democratic ideals to improve the country. And one of the reasons that I am a patriot is that I have seen this country. I was born in segregation in a segregated hospital in a segregated town in a segregated state, Missouri. My first educational experience was a one-room segregated schoolhouse. This country has changed so much in the 76 years that I've lived in it, and it's changed because of people who had the spirit of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Thurgood Marshall and Martin King and all of their white allies, and they've made the country better for blacks, better for gays and lesbians, better for women. The country that I live in now is so much fairer and so much more decent than the country I was born into, and the struggle has been my struggle. I've been in those struggles, and I've helped change the nation, and so yeah, I'm patriotic, but I surely don't believe that we're a perfect country when I was born, and it's not a perfect country now.
Professor Griffin, I want to turn to another aspect of this, which is like who can critique when. You know, black folks have been critiquing America for centuries. Even today, musicians and comedians are complicating the way that we think about America. There's the now defunct TV show Dave Chappelle. He really pushed political boundaries. He once called himself Black Bush and poked fun at the president's reasons for going to war in Iraq.
I got a coalition of the willing. I got 40 nations ready to roll, son.
Like who?
Like who? England, Japan's sending PlayStations. Stankonia said they are willing to drop bombs over Baghdad. Africa Bambaataa and the Zulu Nation. That means I am not doing this by myself, and I'm not disrespecting the UN. Go sell some medicine, b****s.
All right, that's Chappelle, and boy, do I miss him. But, you know, Kanye West had his harsh words for George Bush shortly after Katrina. A lot of white people resonated with those. So is there a sense that certain people can say certain things and other folks can't, depending on the context?
Well, I think that certainly comedy, you know, is a place where we can touch upon dangerous things, you know, and that there's humor that we can make people laugh about it. I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind in this current moment is that there's also a lot of politics being played, and that's not often an arena where we can have these kinds of difficult, serious conversations. Comedy and the arts have often been a place where we could at least broach subjects that are more difficult in, you know, a more serious context.
Is there something, Professor Wilkins, about the very nature of political campaigning that makes everything suspect, including black patriotism?
Well, I think that politics, as it's played in this country, brings out the worst in us, which is, I think, why Barack Obama has been so surprisingly successful, because he's preaching to the best in us. And I think that the way people struggle and argue, for instance, Mark Penn today just dismissed the endorsement of Obama by Bill Richardson as if, well, it's beyond time and he's not a big person anyway. The Clinton campaign was busting its back to get that guy to endorse them. But this is just nasty. It's often almost like sandlot arguments, and there's nothing you can do about it.
All right, we're going to have to end it there, unfortunately. Professor Wilkins, Professor Griffin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Wilkins is the author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers, and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He's also the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History and American Culture at George Mason University. And Farah Jasmine Griffin is Professor of English and African American Studies at Columbia University. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Despite a rough couple of weeks, Barack Obama receives a key endorsement from a former Democratic presidential candidate, and Florida and Michigan may have lost all hope of redoing their primaries. For more, we have Mara Schiavo-Campo, digital correspondent for NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan of the Los Angeles Times, and Roland Martin, CNN contributor and special correspondent for Essence Magazine. Hi, folks.
Hi, Farai.
How are you doing?
So I'm going to start with you, Mara. Today, Bill Richardson endorsed Barack Obama for president. He got huge applause when he said, and I'm quoting here, "Senator Obama opposed the Iraq war from the beginning," and he also said, "end the Iraq war, bring our troops home." It is, of course, the week of the fifth anniversary of the Iraq war. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But will Richardson's endorsement put the brakes on a couple of issues, Mara? One, the bad press that Senator Obama has been getting around the pastor race issue. And two, the idea that he doesn't really resonate with Latinos.
Yeah, I think the answer to both questions is yes. The best thing about this nomination, this endorsement for the Obama campaign, is that it takes the attention off of right, which has been his problem for the last 2 weeks. He says the worst 2 weeks of his campaign. And so this is the best thing that the endorsement is doing for them. In addition, it's one of the reasons that Richardson said that it kind of pushed him over the edge in supporting Obama was that he was very impressed by the race speech. And the speech got really good reviews across the board pretty much. And so it just kind of instills some confidence in Obama in having dealt with that issue. So those are both good things for them.
Now, when you listen to this, Roland, from, you know, more of a standpoint of the horse race, is this an important horse race moment?
Oh, my God, it's huge. I mean, keep in mind, Bill Clinton went to watch the Super Bowl with Bill Richardson at his home there. I mean, the Clinton campaign is trying desperately to dismiss this endorsement when there was one they wanted. Keep in mind, Bill Richardson was energy secretary under Bill Clinton. He was ambassador to the United Nations under Bill Clinton. He also brings significant foreign policy experience. And so by him endorsing Obama, if they're going to be using him as a surrogate, he now can be one of the chief foreign policy surrogates for Senator Barack Obama when it comes to these national television shows. This endorsement also is going to mean that you're likely going to hear stories coming out. Is Bill Richardson a possible vice presidential nominee as well as a result? And so it is no doubt that it helps him him. The Clinton administration, the Clinton camp desperately wanted it, and I don't care how they try to spin it, it is a big blow to them not to have Richardson endorse him, and it does help Obama when it comes to Hispanics because New Mexico is a swing state, and that's the key. Clinton has talked about a big state strategy. New Mexico becomes a swing state. So does Arizona and some of the other southwestern states. Big, big endorsement by Bill Richardson.
Aaron, I have to move on to another issue. You know, I mean, it becomes kind of a, you know, a hall of mirrors when we talk about covering the presidential race because we all listen to each other. Mm-hmm. And in an interview with the radio station, Barack Obama called his grandmother a, quote, typical white person. Mm-hmm. He was referring to, you know, some of her less than enlightened words, I suppose, on race. And then everyone was like, oh, you're just painting white people with this one brush, you know, how can you do that? And it seemed like a case where, you know, first people got on him for being kind of down on his grandmother, it mm-hmm. seemed to some people, and then now stereotyping white people. Mm. Is this, how does this unfold? I mean, is this got, first of all, does this specific issue have traction? And secondly, you know, does it take more effort to dig yourself out than to just shut up and be like, you know what, you guys can think whatever you want.
I go for option B, Farai. I think, you know, so I think Obama, what I thought was a really brilliant speech, sort of done talking about this. I don't think he will or he should go back and try to sort of correct what he has laid out. I think he's put out one of the truths he laid out was that his grandmother was, you know, was probably entirely typical. And by the way, people, you know, what got this whole thing started was this perception that Jeremiah Wright is a typical black person. I mean, that's the inference. He's angry. He's he raises the specter of the kind of black person white people just don't like. That's so, you know, these are things that we have reduced to kind of an irreducible place. I mean, this is sort of the truth, and you really can't get. You know, you can't pretty it up, can't put lipstick on it. And a lot of people just want Obama to apologize in a way that he knows that he cannot. And
No, they don't want him to apologize. They want him to disown his pastor, and
right.
they want him
Sorry.
To
apologize.
Disown his church.
That's the word, yes.
That's what they want, and
they
that's
want
the problem with all of this.
Right, go ahead.
Well, you know what? Is this just been an iffy week for all the candidates? And I'm not lumping them all together in that they've had the same experience. On the one hand, they all have had a breach of security of their passport files. We'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, John McCain mistakenly said that the Iranians were training al-Qaeda. Hillary Clinton had the papers released from her days at first as the first lady, and people are pouring through them, hoping desperately for some story to emerge. If you had to rate this week, and, you know, I guess I'll go to you, Mara. If you had to rate this week in terms of, you know, good, bad, or ugly for the presidential race, what would you say?
It was a bad week for all of them. And I think at the end of this week, you have to ask the question, well, who had the less worse week? I mean, whose was the best of the worst? As you mentioned, you know, McCain had a few gaffes in Iraq, which opened the doors for people to criticize really his qualifications on that front. Hillary had problems with the Florida and Michigan do-overs, which she really wanted, which it doesn't look like are going to happen at all. Obama had problems with Wright, of course. So they all had really tough weeks. If I had to say who had the toughest week, probably Obama. I mean, the last 2 weeks have been really, really tough on him with everything that's happened with Wright. Now, you know, you have the new Gallup poll numbers that came out and that show that, you know, that Clinton is ahead. And those numbers were taken before he made his speech on race. So we'll see if that speech actually helped him at all in kind of ending this bad string, so to speak.
No, Farah, I got to say, though,
yes.
the so-called gaffe he made about the typical white person, that speaks volumes, I think, too, again, to how uncomfortable we are about race. Mm. We know the point actually exists. Frankly, I don't see it as a bad thing because this is March. If Obama is going to get the nomination, you are going to have to deal with those ethnic, those white ethnic blue collar workers who are not going to truly speak their views to pollsters, and they're going to simply be saying these things on talk radio. And by putting it out there now, you confront the reality, and that is there are people who do not want to vote for him because he's black, the people who do not want to address the issue of race from a black perspective or a white perspective. And so I think by putting it on the table, what it is forcing people is to have an actual conversation. The question is, are we in the media going to elevate the conversation, or are we going to ask the same question every day? Is it helping? Is it helping? Is it helping him? Is it hurting him? As opposed to challenging people on their assumptions. That's where it falls on us. And also because you have conservative radio who does not want to move off of this, because we know why. Mm-hmm. Because this is how they've been able to build their infrastructure.
I want to
so
jump
the challenge
in.
Should be to them, too.
Right.
I want to jump in for a second and just reintroduce all of you and the topics in case folks are just tuning in. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. We're talking to Mara Schiavo Campo. I just murdered your name. I'm sorry.
That's all right. You did pretty well,
Mara Schiavo Campo with NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan of the Los Angeles Times, and Roland Martin of CNN and Essence Magazine. So we're talking politics, and I just want to go to you, Aaron, and is there anything really to say about this passport breach, the idea that the data on the three major candidates is just, you know, has been distributed in ways it shouldn't have been? Are you surprised? Is there any news there?
Farai, nothing surprises me anymore, period. But, you know, it has like whiffs of Watergate to me. I mean, I think the one of the we don't really know why this happened, although we can certainly speculate. But obviously, I think the cheap information in looking at someone's passport is to get a to get the social security number, and then you can dig up credit reports and all kinds of great information. I think it's interesting. As someone pointed out in a news report, these employees, there were two who were fired, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And we did not learn about this breach until after those employees were fired. So it makes it more difficult for action to be taken against them. So it's almost as if someone, you know, they were fired quickly because someone knew the consequences, you know, what would happen when this got out. So it's just so bizarre, as you said, this hall of mirrors. Condoleezza Rice apologizing to Obama, saying she did not. No, she seems not know a lot for someone in charge of the State Department. And so I have to say I'm glad that this has come out because, frankly, this probably goes on all the time, and we just don't know. So I'm actually glad that, you know, as ugly as this is, it's being brought to light.
You know, this
great
reminds
for Democrats.
Me.
Yeah.
It's great for Democrats.
Yes.
I mean, it's huge for Democrats, Farai.
Okay, why?
Because the Democrats, look, this is another opportunity by them having now the House and the Senate. They can actually now call for congressional hearings.
Right.
You have subpoenas calling people down to both chambers. And so they can turn this into whatever they want to. This thing may last. Look, it could be innocent. It could be more complex. This thing could go on for 2, 3, 4 months, an opportunity for them to cast the Bush administration as trying to go after the two candidates. And so because also Secretary Rice revealed that Clinton's records were breached in 2007. Well, why didn't we hear about that? And so the Democrats, this is nirvana for them.
Now, this reminds me in a weird way a little bit of this whole, remember when Britney Spears had her medical records tampered with by staff? I mean, people, there's the saying mainly in the techie community, information wants to be free. And Mara, is it just one of these things where people are going to snoop no matter what, or is this something that has much bigger political implications?
Well, you know, right now we don't know. And that's, I mean, where things stand right now, we just have a lot of questions and very few answers. Could it be, as they called it, kind of a nosiness, so to speak? Where you had some employees who were doing a little bit of snooping because they were curious at where people had been or some personal information. Sure, it could be just that. But could it be something deeper? You know, in 1992, supposedly they were looking for damaging information on Bill Clinton about wanting to renounce his citizenship. So could it be something deeper politically motivated? It could be. And could it be absolutely nothing, just human beings being nosy and curious like they were with Britney Spears' medical records? It could be. So it's our job now to figure out exactly what's going on.
I want to move on to yet another topic, and this is one where gosh, there is going to be blood on the floor. First Florida, now Michigan. Michigan's plans for a primary do-over have all but collapsed. The state Senate went on a two-week recess without passing legislation to have a new Democratic primary. How much of a blow is this to both Florida and Michigan voters? You know, I guess I'm going to ask you this first, Mara.
Well, for the voters, I mean, it's hard to say because there were some voters in Michigan who, you know, changed their ballot and Democratic voters who voted Republican because they said their vote wasn't going to count. And so it seems, I mean, that would suggest to me a certain acceptance of the fact that that they were told your vote's not going to count. And so they decided they were going to vote, at least have their vote counted in some capacity. So it's hard to say, you know, how the voters feel about it because, you know, perhaps they've accepted, perhaps they want to fight it. But the bigger question is, what are we going to do moving forward? I mean, the issue of a do-over, that ship has sailed. It's pretty much dead in the water. So the bigger question now is, how are the delegates going to be seated, if at all? And if it's a 50-50 split, you know, that's pretty much a wash. Is that even worthwhile doing? I mean, there are so many questions now as to how to resolve this mess. And it is such a huge mess. And, you know, I heard one commentator say, and it may have even been Roland, that, you know, Democrats sure know how to snatch victory from defeat from the jaws of victory, rather.
Let me jump in for a second because I want to play. I want to play a little bit of Hillary Clinton's speech during a rally in Detroit, Michigan.
Here in Michigan, 600,000 people turned out on a cold and snowy day in January to cast your votes. And you made it abundantly clear that you wanted your voices to be heard and your votes to be counted. And in Florida, 1.7 million people did exactly the same. Now, these nearly 2.5 million Americans are in danger of being shut out of our democratic process. I think that's wrong, and frankly, it is un-American.
Now, I want to ask you this, Roland. In October, Senator Clinton talked to New Hampshire Public Radio about the Michigan primary, and she said, quote, "I personally did not think it made any difference whether or not my name was on the ballot. You know, it's clear this election they're having is not going to count for anything." So why the change in position?
Well, because she's losing. You know, and this whole grandstanding by Senator Clinton, oh, stop and sit down. She's losing. When she was leading, she had no problem with that. Not only that, people should ask the question, how many people who serve on her campaign sit on the Rules Committee? It was a unanimous decision to strip them. The people in Florida and Michigan, you should not be mad at Howard Dean and the DNC. You shouldn't be mad at Senator Obama. You shouldn't be mad at Senator Clinton. You should be mad at the bums who represent you in those two states who chose to be so arrogant that they say we are going to jump ahead of everybody else. Here's the one thing that everybody keeps overlooking. 48 states followed the rules. 2 broke the rules. What are the 2 states crying right now saying our voices are not being heard? Florida and Michigan. And the Democrats keep complaining about the Republicans in Florida. It was a Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor led by also Senator Carl Levin in Michigan, a Democrat. They disenfranchised themselves. And I do feel for the voters, but it was the elected officials. So if I was in Florida and Michigan, throw those bums out of office. They're the ones who disenfranchise you.
All right, Aaron, we only have time for a quick hit. Who do you think should be responsible for making this right? Is it Howard Dean? Who is it?
No, I'm with Roland on this one. This decision was made by the party, and it was a very quote unquote democratic process. And he's absolutely right. It's only an issue now because, of course, every delegate vote counts. Every vote counts. But we're just gonna have to do without Florida and Michigan. And I'm frankly glad that we're moving on and leaving it alone because I just think it'd be more of a mess to do a do-over. That seems to me more problematic in the end than just moving on. I mean, so, and I agree with Roland. You know, you go after the people who made this decision to disenfranchise themselves. I mean, this wasn't about people. You know, the people getting cheated. This wasn't about election fraud. This was about a very clear decision. And if they don't like the decision, then like Roland said, throw the bumps out of office.
All right. On that note, thank you guys so much, and happy Friday.
Thank you.
Thanks a bunch.
We've been talking with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan of the Los Angeles Times, Roland Martin, CNN contributor and special correspondent for Essence magazine. He was at WBEZ in Chicago, and Mara Schiavo-Campo, digital correspondent for NBC's Nightly News with Brian Williams. She joined us from our New York studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. If you were diagnosed with HIV or AIDS, you'd face new physical realities, new medications for one, and you might also question how your life would unfold. Would you have a long life on the new medical regimens? What would your friends and family think if you told them? We continue our series on mental health with a look at the psychological dimensions of HIV and AIDS, from the trauma of receiving the news to the side effects brought on by AIDS medications. Carla Bailey is co-chair of the L.A. County Commission on HIV. She's waded through many of the mental setbacks that come with being HIV positive. She's been living with the disease for 12 years. And Regan Hoffman has also been living with HIV for 12 years. She's the editor-in-chief of PAWS. That's a magazine for people living with and around HIV. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Carla. The last time you were on the show with us, you talked a little bit about the depression that hit you after you were diagnosed. Remind us a little bit about that story, how you found out and you know, kind of how you kept to yourself.
Well, it took me a minute, but I had a partner that died, hadn't been to a doctor in years. I have an older sister that's a medical professional. And through a few years, I lost friends. I lost my significant other's mother to cancer. There was a lot of stuff going on. And then I lost him and then my mother. And all of this happened within about 7 months. I continued to work because I had kids, one in college, two in high school. And it was my job to make sure they got their educations. And so I worked. That's all I did. That was my life, my kids and my job. I was in real estate, and I was making money, and we were living pretty well. But my sister is my sister, and she's the one that always, it's five girls, you guys get your breast exams. Have you had your pap smears? Well, you know, that kind of thing. And I've always didn't want to go to the doctor. But for 3 years, she pushed and prodded, and finally she made an appointment for me. And I went in, she said, you need a physical. You know, you've lost so many people, and you look so depressed, and you don't do anything but work. So to shut her up, I'm like, oh, no problem. I'm going to this doctor just so you can be quiet. While I'm there, I was asked about an HIV test. I took the test, and I had to come back for results. Where they sent me didn't look like the place where I initially started. And when I walked to the door, I stopped outside the door and looked up to make sure I was in the right place because the people inside looked sick, in wheelchairs, some on crutches, thin, the wasting syndrome, the whole thing. And I'm like, oh my God. So the lady that was sitting inside the receptionist motioned me to come in. I walked in. I said, I think I'm in the wrong place. And she asked me my name. She said, no, you're in the right place. Have a seat. The doctor will be with you. I get into this room with this doctor, and he starts asking me questions. And finally, I just said, look, you're asking me too many questions. What's going on? What did you find? And he said, you have full-blown AIDS. You have 12 T-cells and 1.1 million copies of virus. That was the last thing I heard. I don't know what else he said to me after that. There were so many things going through my head, and I was so afraid and so scared and not knowing what to do. I ended up going home, and later that evening, I called my sister. And I'm like, I need to talk to you. You need to come over. And I told her what was going on with me. It was hard just to even talk to her, to tell her. Her reaction was basically like mine. But she's a healthcare professional. She's like, okay, we got to take care of this. Her friend is my doctor and is still my doctor. He didn't start out being my doctor, but he told her he'd take care of me.
And you look great, by the way. You're sitting here with me right now in a radiant orange outfit. And, I mean, would you have thought at that time that you would be in a position not just to be healthy, but also to be helping other people?
No, I thought I was going to die. As a matter of fact, I remember praying for it.
Praying to die.
I prayed to God to please let me die and not like these other people that I'm watching go through this long, drawn out illness that just, it breaks your heart. And I was like, I thought about my kids, and I'm from a family of eight, and there's eight of us, and I'm like, oh my God, my siblings. Then it came down to how do you tell the rest of your family? Because we lost our mother, it was just us. So we decided we'd have a barbecue, which is where we get news, pregnancies, and whatever else is going on in the family. And it was kind of somber. Matter of fact, it was really somber. My sisters were okay because these women go to church. My brothers, I'd never seen my brothers cry like that. And it's like, what are we going to do? And I could feel one of them when he grabbed and hugged me. He says, what are we going to do? I'm like, we live till we die.
Let me get Regan in here. You've been HIV positive for the same amount of time, roughly, as Carla. And you, too, also have moved into a position where you're helping other people. Your magazine creates a sense of community, in fact. What do you hear from the community about this initial blow when you first find out that you're positive?
Well, you know, it's really different today than it was when I was first diagnosed. I had a very similar reaction when they told me my doctor had never diagnosed a woman before. I think he was as shocked as I was in 1996. You know, neither of us knew what to say. Today, people, fortunately, are often diagnosed by someone who understands the disease a bit better, and so the news is less dire. And of course, when people are diagnosed today, there are a lot of medical options for them. So it's not an instant death sentence. But I think in a way, we've almost come too far in convincing people that AIDS is a chronic, manageable condition because, you know, as we're talking about, this is a very difficult disease to withstand physically as well as emotionally. And it's a double-edged sword. We want people to not fear AIDS or people living with AIDS, but we also don't want people to continue to get this disease that's preventable. So
sometimes, you know, we see statistics that say that, you know, infection rates are up among certain groups of younger people or certainly among black women. And you're thinking that in a way people don't take the disease seriously? Is that what I'm hearing?
People don't think that we have an AIDS epidemic in America. They think it's an African problem, an Indian problem. I mean, we have more cases and more people living with HIV than ever before on the planet, especially in the United States. The odds of you getting AIDS today are higher. And women are continuing in particular to be diagnosed with AIDS as opposed to just, you know, being identified as HIV positive. And there's no reason for this. People should be getting tested. Doctors should be looking for the symptoms. I think there's complacency. I think there's, you know, we've done a great job educating people, raising awareness about AIDS. But I think the missing link is that people don't believe it can really happen to them. And part of that's because people living with HIV are afraid to come forward because of the stigma. So there I know thousands of women like myself and Carla, and, you know, they're just living in isolation and they're terrified. And if they're lucky enough to have families that are supportive or loved ones, that's great. But they're not out in the public eye, so nobody believes that it can happen to them. That's what happened to me. I mean, in the beginning of the 80s, I thought I was terrified of HIV. But by the mid-90s, I was back to being concerned that I was going to get pregnant, and that was the worst thing that could happen to me until, of course, this did.
I want to bring in Dr. Michelle Clark. She's the president of the Golden State Medical Association and a psychiatrist who works with the psychological dimensions of HIV and AIDS. Dr. Clark, we have heard just a little bit about more of the revelation period, but what else happens once you are diagnosed with HIV among your patients after that initial shock? What other sorts of issues come up?
The many issues that come up with people living with HIV are first the management of recognizing and accepting what all is involved in living with HIV. This is separate and distinct from any ongoing mental health problems that they may have. And I want to emphasize that being HIV positive does not necessarily mean that you have psychological difficulty. Because I don't want it to be misconstrued that mental health issues are part of the diagnosis. But it is a fact of life that people have to adjust with any chronic illness. HIV is now a chronic illness, as many other illnesses that we have to live with in our community, diabetes, hypertension, etc. The problem with HIV is the uniqueness of this particular virus, its mutability, the challenges in remaining with the protocol so as not to become resistant. All of these things are unique and make it even more difficult to manage the illness. So it's very, very important that people can see through the shock and dismay and other emotional feelings that they go through, similar to any grief reaction, denial,
anger, etc. It's important that they're able to see through that to the important information that they need to get in order to live successfully with the disease. One young man who was on earlier, I'm sorry I didn't come in time to get everybody's name, was saying that after his numbers were announced to him, he didn't hear anything else. And that is so commonly the case. The important thing is to assist folks in hearing through that. The way to do that, of course, is to provide them with written information that they can pass on to loved ones, significant others who can help them absorb all of the information that needs to be absorbed, and to support them through all of the emotional changes that they may go through. There is no one way that people do it. Everyone is unique. Everyone is different. And so everyone handles things differently.
That was Carla, who you heard speaking before. And unfortunately, we don't have too much time. I mean, this is a topic that that is so important. But what I do want to do in our closing minutes is talk a little bit about strategies that you have for dealing with things when they're not going right. I'm going to start with you, Regan. What I mean is either when you feel down or whether you feel stigmatized by other people, what kind of resources, emotional resources, do you go to?
I'm lucky because I have an incredible family and I can talk to them, and I would encourage anybody to confide in people about HIV. People can actually, armed with the right information, get their heads around this disease, and they are happy to help you. So I call my friends, but I've done a pretty good job educating them and going out on a limb, and in response, I've been specific about telling them what I need. I've said to them, please ask me how I feel. You know, don't be afraid to talk to me about AIDS. Don't be afraid to bring it up. Think about this as if I had breast cancer or, you know, another condition. Talk to me. And that, by giving them the green light to do that, they've done that. And that has made me feel so normal. And then I think just in general, having people, my friends and family, know that, like, you know, just hugging me, touching me, you know, sharing my soda or dipping their, you know, French fries in my ketchup, as my younger sister did the first day that I told her I had HIV, treating me like I'm normal is really just an act of solidarity, and it has helped me feel normal and non-infectious, which is a great health builder for me. So I think just being open with me about it, taking the responsibility on themselves to educate themselves about it, and then being and acting comfortable around me has been extremely helpful.
All right. We have time for just a short comment from you, Carla. Where do you go when you're feeling spiritually depleted?
Well, I'm a spiritual person, so I read my Bible a lot. That's where I get a lot of comfort most of the time. But I have a great, like Regan, a support base of family and friends. And then what I tell people is, I'm not the disease. I'm a person living with a disease. If I had a choice, it would be not to have it. So my choice is for everybody out there that's not infected, is for them not to become infected. Get an HIV screening. Keep your health straight.
All right. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Regan Hoffman, editor-in-chief of PAWS magazine. She joined us from our New York studios. Psychologist, psychiatrist Dr. Michelle Clark. She specializes in the psychological dimensions of HIV and AIDS. And Carla Bailey, a single mother living with HIV, also co-chair of the L.A. County Commission on HIV. The man who starred in Nothing But a Man, a landmark film about racial injustice in America, has died. Actor, director, and producer Ivan Dixon died on Sunday, March 16th in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was 76 years old. Dixon was probably most widely known for his role as a staff sergeant on the 1960s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. But it was his role as a railroad worker in Nothing But a Man that he considered the most significant. Dixon said he felt he was reliving his life when he acted in the 1964 film about a couple grappling with race and poverty in the South.
Where are you going to go?
When I get set, I'll send for you.
I don't think that'll happen.
You'd be better off without me. I ain't fit to live with no more. It's just like a lynching. Maybe they don't use a knife on you, but they got other ways.
He went on to act in the Broadway and film productions of A Raisin in the Sun with Sidney Poitier. Some of his other film credits include Something of Value, A Patch of Blue, and the classic 70s comedy Car Wash. In the 1970s, he turned to directing films and TV shows, including episodes of The Twilight Zone, Perry Mason, and The Outer Limits. Throughout his career, he worked to help other black actors into the film and television industry. In 1967, he told the New York Times, "Sponsors haven't wanted anything negative connected with their products. We must convince them that the Negro is not negative." His awards include 4 NAACP Image Awards, the National Black Theater Award, and the Paul Robeson Pioneer Award from the Black American Cinema Society. He died of a brain hemorrhage and had suffered complications from kidney failure. He is survived by his wife of 53 years, a daughter, and a son. He had 2 other sons who died before him. Family members say that at his request, a memorial service is not planned. That's Nicole. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel and Sia Boadi produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits. Devin Robbins and Kenya Young direct the show. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, and Christopher Johnson. Our interns are Paige Lindell and Drew Tewksbury. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Next week, Torchy Brown, Candy, Patty Joe, and Ginger, all comic strip characters drawn by America's first black woman cartoonist. Jackie Orms illustrated for some of the nation's leading black newspapers more than half a century ago. Now she's the subject of a new book on her trailblazing popular art.